I'm Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. When we think back to the Revolutionary War, most of us remember the actions of the major players like Paul Revere, George Washington, the Marquis de Lafayette, or Benedict Arnold, and that most of it took place in the North. But with his first novel, and the first novel ever written by an American president, Jimmy Carter weaves a tale of both fictional and historical characters to show that much of the war was actually fought in the Deep South, and that it was a war that pitted neighbor against neighbor, Native American against colonist, and men and women against their own conflicted loyalties. The Hornet's Nest is now being released in paperback by Simon & Schuster, and it is my great honor to welcome Jimmy Carter back to the show. Do I still call you Mr. President?
Oh, Jimmy's fine. By the way, I want to point out that I was born the same year that WNYC was born. It's 80 years ago.
Well.
So we have a lot in common already.
This may be the first novel by an American president, but surely not the first work of fiction. Is the difference here that you're willing to own up to the fact that you've invented all of this?
Well, I didn't use any fiction when I was president and when I was running for office. Maybe in contrast to some other candidates.
And, a few have been caught.
But this is the first novel I found out later that a president had ever written. But I had earlier written 17 other books, autobiographies, memoirs, books on how to negotiate peace agreements, the causes of war, an analysis of the Mideast conflict, a couple of religious books, a book of poetry. So I thought it was about time for me to try something different, and I decided to get with some of my other college professors. This is my 23rd year as a professor at Emory University, and they happened to be teachers of creative writing, so they took me under their wing and gave me some long, tedious instruction as an eager student on how to write.
But you could have gotten that instruction and written a work of nonfiction and still told us an awful lot that we didn't know.
Well, I wanted to bring it alive. And it was only after I began doing research, which took 7 years, that I saw the remarkable nature of that war and also found that it was completely different from what I had always learned in school. As you outlined in your brief summary at the beginning, if you ask most people what they know about the war, even history professors, they'll say they remember we had skirmishes around Boston, that George Washington crossed the Delaware in a snowstorm, and that Paul Revere rode a horse at night, and that Cornwallis surrendered in southern Virginia. That's all anybody knows about the war, and it was the most important war of America's evolutionary history. And also, it's one of the most rarely described wars either in history books or fiction.
And you say that's because most of the historians are from the North, or the important... Well, George Washington spent most of the time during the war in the North, so that has to be a key factor here. We focus on his accomplishments.
Well, despite the fact that he was a great leader in every possible way, he never won a major battle. In fact, for 3.5 or more years, as you know, our army and the British army were in a complete stalemate. And Washington's greatest challenge was not fighting a battle, but how to avoid a battle that might cost him his army. And secondly, to control the enormous inclination on American revolutionaries to desert from George Washington and go back home because of the stalemated war. In the meantime, the British, operating out of New York City by sea down to Savannah and coming up from St. Augustine, Florida to Savannah, began to retake the entire continent. And they moved in through Georgia, through both Carolinas, through Virginia, and were making very good headway toward New York City when the French joined us as allies and, in effect, saved our revolution.
So what were the important military leaders? Who were they who fought the battles in the South? And where were the big battles fought? I know about Yorktown.
Well, they were primarily guerrillas or... In the North, they were known as Minutemen. They were volunteers. And the troubling thing was that, and what a lot of people don't remember, is that every citizen of this continent at the beginning was completely loyal to the King of England. They had taken, any adult, numerous oaths before God to be loyal to the King. And this is a special war because there was no geographical boundary of it. and obviously in Vietnam and Korea, and then the European conflicts with the First and Second World War, there was a geographical delineation, even in the Civil War. If you lived north of the Mason-Dixon line, you were probably Yankee. South, you were probably Confederate. In this war, there was no geographical division. And what would happen was that one member of a family, say a senior son, would decide, I'm going to take up weapons against my own king. In a few days, he would be fighting against his own brothers and his own father on the battlefield. And he would probably be wearing a revolutionary outfit, and his brothers and father would be wearing a red coat.
And a lot of people forget that after the war finally came to an end, quite a few people just picked up and left, moved to Canada,
yes,
or moved to England.
The ones who had remained Tories or remained loyal to the king, both fighters and those who did not fight, felt that they would not be welcome here anymore. So a lot of them moved to the Caribbean, a lot of them moved to Florida, a lot of them moved to Newfoundland, a lot of them moved back to the mainland in Europe.
But you said earlier that there were no real geographic lines of distinction like the Mason-Dixon line later, but there were differences. Although slavery took place all over the country at that time, was allowed all over the country, it was mostly based in the South, and weren't people fighting for different reasons in the South than they were in the North?
Not really. I think that in the South, in Georgia and the Carolinas, there was earlier a reluctance to fight, and we didn't really have slavery in Georgia up until the Revolutionary period, except very scattered slavery. As a matter of fact, Georgia was only 30 miles wide then from the Atlantic Ocean and the Savannah River. All the rest of Georgia was owned and controlled by the Indians, the Creek and Cherokee Indians. And it was only after the war when Eli Whitney...
I thought it was Tom DeLay who owned it all.
Tom DeLay owns Texas now, and he's trying to take over the rest of it. You're right. But the Indians controlled the hinterlands then, and, of course, there was a major battle, politically speaking and economically speaking, between the British and American revolutionaries, who would get the Indians to support them. But slavery only really took over in the South, deep South, after the development of the cotton gin, when big plantations evolved and massive numbers of slaves began to come in.
So that was later.
Yes.
You said that the Revolutionary War was the war that shaped the character of the country. In what way?
Well, it defined who we were and what we might be. I think this was a war, like others in which we fought, perhaps, that was not really necessary. Had the British Parliament been a little more sensitive to the legitimate demands of the colonists, there would not have been a war. I don't think there's any doubt that in a few more decades, at the longest, America would have been an independent country, as has happened since then, in Canada and Australia and India, where the British Empire came apart. So we would ultimately have been independent without the bloody battles. But this was a war that I think was a torturous and difficult decision made by individual citizens of then colonial England. As one by one, in increasing numbers, the revolutionaries took up weapons to fight against their own government.
In a way, it set the tone for anti-colonial battles in the 20th century throughout Africa, or earlier, I guess, in Latin America, but nobody had ever done anything like that until the American Revolution.
That's certainly true. And as you may know, even after the Second Continental Congress in Philadelphia, which was quite advanced during the altercation with Great Britain, our leaders, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, all the rest of them, were sending a very conciliatory official letters to the King of England just wanting to have peace and a reconciliation of differences. It was only a few hotheads around who stirred up the problem, and of course Thomas Paine wrote his historic Common Sense, and that convinced tens of thousands of people. There were a lot of people then. Let's take up weapons against the king, who in the past had been sacrosanct, almost sacred.
Ethan Pratt, your protagonist, moves from Philadelphia to North Carolina and then to Georgia, where he becomes associated with a Quaker community. Did one of your ancestors go through a similar wandering?
Yes. Before I started writing this book, I knew about the history of my own family, and my Carter family came over to this country in the mid-1600s, and then lived around New Jersey and Philadelphia for a while, then moved down to North Carolina, joined a colony of Quakers, although they were not Quakers, and moved down to Georgia about 1760. So I knew about this general outline of their of my own family's history. And then, of course, they did participate in the Revolutionary War from the perspective of a Georgian. And this is where the book's major historical facts come to life, but also where the fictional characters add life and excitement and tie the battles in all together.
Did your family have any kind of oral history that might have given you an insight? It's a pretty long time ago.
Well, I didn't have any interest in my family for most of my life. I was in the Navy, then I ran for governor, then I ran for president. When I got to be president, after about 2 years, the Mormon church leaders, Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, asked me for an appointment at the White House, and I thought they had some kind of problem in Africa or something with Mormons. When they got there, though, they had created, I think, a very definitive, history of my family. And they delivered it to me in a beautiful leather-bound book with all the documents. So it was only then that I became at all interested in my family's background and history. And so they were the ones that really provided me with that. And, of course, I still have some of the documents. The land in Georgia where we still live, we've had the same land now since 1833, 170-some years, was awarded to us because revolutionary members of my family from the Revolutionary War won lottery drawings because of their service in the war and gained the property that we still own.
Although they weren't farming peanuts then, were they?
No, but
they came later.
They were farming rice and corn and livestock feed and beginning to grow cotton.
And you give us some pretty detailed descriptions of farming techniques of the time, also the flora, the battles, even leather shoemaking. Was that detail something that you felt was important to put in?
It was. I wanted to add authenticity not only to the battles themselves and to the strategic military struggles, which I think are quite accurate, but also add some really background and color. How did the people actually live? How did they build houses? How did they travel? How did they make furniture? How did they grow rice and flax? How did they make shoes? So these kinds of things I wanted to put in the book. I studied this background for this book for about 7 years and did this kind of research. Not only historians, who were quite biased, as a matter of fact, after the war was over, any American historian was, every sentence in every history book is condemning the British as criminals and scoundrels, and is exalting the Americans, and vice versa. And I also read biographies of both generals and privates in the British and American armies, so I could understand the perspective that was quite in conflict on different battles.
So you don't give us good guys and bad guys.
They're good guys and bad guys on the American side. They're good guys and bad guys on the British side.
But there is brutality in the fighting and some appalling atrocities that you describe. That's also not part of our historical memory. Is that what happens in time? We just make it all into something very romantic because this is the beginning of this country? And I think in general, don't we often try not to think about the atrocities of war?
Probably more than any other war, this Revolutionary War was exemplified broadly by incredible atrocities. There was a pattern that evolved, particularly in the southern battles, of such intense hatred that they would grant no quarter, which meant that if you surrendered at the end of a battle, you would not be taken prisoner. You would be immediately executed with a bayonet in your gut or with a bullet through your brain. And this became a pattern on both sides. And the reason was that the people hated each other so badly, having been members of the same family. For instance, one of the big battles was on King's Mountain, which is right on the border between North and South Carolina. There were about 1,000 people fighting on top of the mountain. Every one of them was an American colonist. Half of them wore redcoats because they stayed loyal to the king. The other half were revolutionaries. And only one British was on top of that mountain, and that was a commanding officer.
Well, you're pointing out here that most of the Redcoats were actually locals, people who either had lived here all their lives or had moved here. They weren't those imported troops from England and the Hessians that we've read about so much in our history books.
That's exactly right.
And that's something that we forget. But also, remembering atrocities is a big problem in this country. John Kerry is hated by any number of people for talking about atrocities in Vietnam, even though he's not the only person to have pointed out that there were.
Well, I remember right very near my own home in Plains, Georgia, at Fort Benning, the trial was put on for the My Lai massacre, where 120 completely innocent people were deliberately assassinated, as you know, during the Vietnam War. So there were a lot of atrocities in that war. And this was quite different kinds of people, because we looked on the Vietnamese then as gooks or something of that kind, subhuman species. Whereas in the Revolutionary War, the animosity and hatred and violence and murder was just as bad, but these were our former brothers and members of our own family.
Now, you wrote this book, you said it took you 7 years.
Yes.
Obviously, you were doing other things at the same time. But you also drew the cover illustration for
I'm an amateur artist.
Are you into bookbinding as well?
Not quite.
How far do you go?
I was beginning to do some painting, and the publishers, Simon & Schuster, proposed to me an N.C. Wyeth painting for the cover. And when I looked at it, I saw that it was not of my characters. The guy had black short hair, and he was standing by a canoe. And it turned out to be Daniel Boone, so I decided to paint my own cover for both the hardback and the paperback book.
And the hardcover became a bestseller, and now it's available in paperback, The Hornet's Nest, a novel of the Revolutionary War by Jimmy Carter, published by Simon & Schuster Paperbacks. Now, we will continue our conversation after we take a little break here on WNYC. Stay with us. We're back with Jimmy Carter here on WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. And we're talking about his 18th book, the New York Times bestseller, The Hornet's Nest, which is a novel of the Revolutionary War, now available in paperback from Simon & Schuster. And if you don't mind, can we talk about some other things as well? I mean, here I have this opportunity to talk to somebody who actually sat in the White House. You left the White House at the age of 56, and you, as you told us earlier, you just turned 80 a few weeks ago. During the 24 intervening years, you've been perhaps the most active, at least on the political level, of any ex-president, so much so that you've been called a man on a mission. What have you seen as your mission since you left the White House?
Well, I graduated from the White House, retired 4 years earlier than I wanted to be, involuntarily. And I realized that because of life expectancy, I had about 25 more years to live. What was I going to do with 25 years? So I decided that I would establish an entity, something based on Camp David, where people who had a conflict or potential conflict could come to our center, and I would mediate between them and try to avoid a war or end a war. And that's still part of what we do. The other thing
let's talk about that for a moment,
please.
Because not every administration has appreciated that.
No, they haven't. What we do, which sometimes arouses criticism, to put it mildly, is we deal with reprobates and outcasts in society who are causing unnecessary wars or who are perpetrating human rights abuses, and with whom most of the leaders in the Western world won't even communicate. So by default, in order to end a war, or prevent a war, or end a human rights abuse, we go to that leader and that leader's adversaries and try to resolve the problem.
The Kim Jong-ils of the world.
Exactly, and the General Cedras in Haiti and the President Mengistu, who was a communist dictator in Ethiopia. We go to those people and try to end wars, and we've been remarkably successful with it.
I gather that actually the Bush administration has been more receptive to your efforts than the Clinton administration was.
Well, Bush Sr. was, the first Bush. Yes.
Did he talk to you about these things before you went? Did that so that you could at least be in sync with Washington's approach to...
Well, I've had a policy that when we go into a sensitive area, like North Korea or like Haiti or like Bosnia, for instance, or like Ethiopia, we don't go there unless we get at least tacit approval from the White House. But I've had the most receptive leadership with George Bush Sr. and with his Secretary of State, Jim Baker, than I have with any other administration. And so they have sometimes come to the Carter Center and taken the initiative, why don't you go into this country and see if you can't bring about peace instead of war? That's been very helpful to us. Other times we've gotten, I would say, reluctant approval for us to go, but we don't ever go into that kind of area unless we do get permission from the White House. In most cases, we have programs now in 65 countries, 35 of which are in Africa. In most cases, the White House has very little, if any, interest in the kinds of countries in which we've become involved.
Well, do you see any irony in the fact that you've also gone to any number of countries to watch the electoral process, and now people are saying that we should have people come to the United States because there is so much concern about electoral fraud here?
Well, the Carter Center has now completed monitoring 52 nations' elections. The last one was in Indonesia, the fourth largest country in the world. It's just moved toward democracy recently. And before that, Venezuela. And the next one will be in a few weeks, will be Mozambique. But we go all over the country guaranteeing people when we go in as monitors that the election will be honest and fair and uniform and, in effect, safe. And it's just a tragedy that in our own country, the level of confidence in the electoral system has reached an unprecedented low. People don't have confidence now that their registration will be honored, that they'll be treated equally with all the other citizens in the state, say Ohio or Florida, or that their votes will be counted accurately.
And we've had some real evidence of that in Nevada. There have been registration forms that have been thrown out because one of the parties was collecting it, not the other. In Florida, we hear people being intimidated as well. There's also, some people say that part of the problem is there's no uniformity of voting procedure in
this
country.
Well, that's true. And after the debacle in Florida in 2000, the President Gerald Ford in Iowa asked to head up a 50-person bipartisan commission, a kind of a blue-ribbon commission, to revamp the entire nationwide political system for electoral purposes. And we made some profoundly good, I think, recommendations on them. They were unanimous between Republicans and Democrats, but very few of them have actually not yet been implemented. And I think they should be. In some countries around the world, almost all the recommendations that we made in the United States have already been put into effect. In the so-called third world countries, they have honest and fair and open and trusted elections with completely non-biased administrators, but not in the United States.
During your speech in July at the Democratic National Convention, you said that, I'm quoting, our dominant international challenge is to restore the greatness of America. Truth is the foundation of our global leadership, but our credibility has been shattered and we are left increasingly isolated and vulnerable in a hostile world. How has our credibility been shattered?
I don't think there's any doubt now that around the world, they trust and confidence in the United States is at a historic low. My wife and I have visited more than 120 nations on Earth. And with the outbreak of the Iraqi war and with the obviously incorrect statements made about its cause, that there were massive weapons of mass destruction there, that our country was directly threatened by the strength of the military forces of Saddam Hussein, that somehow Saddam Hussein was responsible for the attack of 9/11. All of those things have proven to be completely false, either deliberately statements of inaccuracy or inadvertent statements of inaccuracy. And I think the unilateral decision of the United States to go to this unnecessary and unjust war has alienated a lot of countries that would have been eager to help if we had called out to them to do so, because after 9/11, there was probably an unprecedented and universal approval for and sympathy for and support for the United States to fight terrorism, and we have abandoned or rejected those offers of support.
You said in that speech, recent policies have cost our nation its reputation as the world's most admired champion of freedom and justice. But why do you think that other countries have lost their respect for us, and yet the citizens of the United States don't seem to be all that upset about what you were just talking about?
Well, we have been...
The missing weapons of mass destruction and other things.
We have been the recipients, I started to say victims, we've been the recipients of a massive public relations effort perpetrated on the American people, claiming every week that we were seriously in danger, that we were being saved, you know, by the administration in power, that all the other countries were erroneous in their beliefs, that there were really still some thoughts, some beliefs that massive threats came from Iraq, and another very important factor is that when any leader, no matter who, whether this generation or previous ones, changes from the role of a civilian administrator with all the arguments back and forth about welfare and taxation and health and that sort of thing, into the commander-in-chief of military forces in danger overseas, that automatically elevates that commander-in-chief to a position where it's not proper or acceptable to be critical.
But you just talked about a global test, and when yes. John Kerry talked about that, he was pounced upon.
I don't think that I watched the debate. I don't think John Kerry ever insinuated that he was going to ask other people for permission for the United States to defend itself. What he said was that in the future, when we do go to war, that our reasons will be so sound and our explanations will be so clear and truthful that other countries will have confidence in us.
When you presided over the negotiations between Begin and Sadat that led to the Camp David Accords in 1979,
yes.
Did you have a feeling that that was just the beginning of a process? Are you surprised by the way things have turned out?
I was quite surprised. That's been one of my most fervent and constant prayers, that the Israeli people and her neighbors could find peace. As a matter of fact, that treaty that I did negotiate, as you say, in 1979, not a word of it has ever been violated, but it's the last time that a permanent agreement has been reached. And I would say that every administration prior to this one has been fervent in their effort to find some accommodation between Israel and her neighbors. This administration has now abandoned that effort altogether. And as you know, the entire situation over there has deteriorated quite rapidly because of that.
You told Jim Lehrer the conflict between Israel and its neighbors is kind of like a cancer that breeds animosity against the United States in many parts of the world.
That's certainly true. I think, obviously, there are many reasons for the rise of animosity toward our country, but one of the most difficult ones to address by me or anyone else is to show the world that the United States is balanced and determined to bring about a resolution of the altercation between Israel and her neighbors, and to provide justice and peace, not only for the Israelis, but also for the Palestinians. That's not being done.
But there were attempts by Bill Clinton.
And he made
and he tried real hard, and in fact, people even ridiculed him.
And he made good progress, too. Yeah.
But now we're in the same situation, and people in the Muslim world somehow blame the United States for anything that they disagree with in Israeli policy, because they see us as the protector of Israel, or they see Israel as some kind of arm of the United States.
Well, as you would certainly remember, when Bill Clinton left office, there was not this animosity at all, because the general presumption around the world was that Bill Clinton and his predecessors, Democratic and Republican, had done the best we could always to bring about an end to the violence in the Mideast and to provide peace and justice to the Israelis and their neighbors. But this has been abandoned in the last 3.5 years, and that's why the animosity is so fervent against us.
You've been writing a lot of op-ed pieces. You wrote one about the possibilities of real problems in Florida during this election. You also wrote one last week in which you urged the Supreme Court to halt juvenile execution.
Yes.
So what are your thoughts about the issue before them in reviewing Roper versus Simmons?
Well, I hope they'll be just and will honor basic principles of human rights and forego in the future the authentication of killing children for crimes they commit. As a matter of fact, as a result of a massive gathering here at the United Nations a number of years ago when the Treaty of the Rights of the Child were concluded, the United States and Somalia, which has no government, are the only two nations in the world that have rejected the terms of that treaty. And the reason the United States has rejected the terms of the rights of the child around the world is because we insist on the right to execute children for crimes committed.
But does it really matter whether it's a child or not? Isn't the death penalty the death penalty? I mean, either, if you're going to extend it, then you have to extend it to a child who might very well kill again. And if you're going to eliminate it, then you have to cover everybody, don't you?
Well, I think there's always a chance that anyone who is not executed can commit another crime. But the international conclusion, now joined in, as I said, unanimously except for the United States and a non-country in Somalia, is that we will not begin to execute anyone for a crime committed unless they are adults. Last year, as you know, partially because of effort by my wife and others at the Carter Center and many others, they finally concluded that a mentally retarded person without adequate adult capabilities or faculties could no longer be executed. And I thought we'll do the same thing with children.
Your activities at the Carter Center have really been fighting for human rights and fair elections. Over the past few years, the American psyche has had to withstand the traumas of viewing the pictures from Abu Ghraib and some harrowing reports from Guantanamo and the chances of undergoing another contested election, as you have written yourself, very high. So how does it affect you personally that the very ideals that you've been exporting to the world are now so sorely needed at home?
Well, I think it's accurate to say that Harry Truman, for instance, and almost all other leaders, certainly, down through my administration and afterwards, felt that it was appropriate in this country to raise high the banner of basic human rights, civil rights at home, human rights around the world. And we endorsed enthusiastically the basic principles of the Geneva Convention, which laid down some minimal requirements for the proper treatment of prisoners. And our Constitution of the United States guarantees that people in our country would not be arrested and incarcerated without trial, without access to attorneys, without being charged with a crime. And this has been done in a massive way in our country after 9/11. There were probably 1,500 people in our country, just because they happen to look like Arabs, who were incarcerated and kept incommunicado for months. We don't even know how long. And others were brought to, as you saw, Guantanamo. Now they're slowly but kind of secretly being released because they can't find any crimes that they've committed. And, of course, the embarrassment of the Grave prison has also been a worldwide problem. And that's because some of our leaders, certainly not all of them, have announced publicly that's filtered down onto to the private and sergeant level that it's really okay to perpetrate these people if it's done under the guise or claim of controlling terrorism.
We spoke recently to someone who was arrested in Philadelphia on September 12, 2001, because he told a cop that he was an Arab from Israel. Spent a year and 17 days uncharged, yes. And eventually was forced to sign something that said he would not come back to the United States for 10 years, went back home. And, of course, he's telling everybody what a terrible place the United States is.
Well, I think it's obvious that George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin and others would be very discomfited to know that Americans are arrested, put in prison without charge against them, no access to their own family, no access to an attorney, and kept there for months and months. This is not part of the American basic consciousness and basic commitment to freedom and human rights.
It would seem that you, of all the ex-presidents of recent memory, are the most outwardly religious. What are your thoughts about the recent melding of faith and politics in Washington?
Well, I grew up as a Southern Baptist in a little town that now has 635 people. We have 11 churches in our town for that few people. And I was endued with the belief of total separation of church and state, that the church should not try to interfere in the political processes of our country, and also that leaders who hold public office, no matter what their own political faith, religious faith might be, should not try to endorse or exalt their own faith to the detriment or preference of others. That's a separation that was formerly extant in this country, but it's being slowly chipped away now.
By any number of religions, John Kerry is under fire for not adhering to his religious beliefs in the formulation of abortion and stem cell policies, to the point where Archbishop Charles Caput, is that his name, of Denver, says that Catholics who vote for him will be committing a sin and will have to go to the confessional.
Well, that's true, and that's an example of what I've always deplored, not as a Catholic but as a Baptist, and that is the insertion of religious leaders' political opinions into the religious realm of life.
But people see this as a character issue, don't they? They're saying that if you believe in certain religious tenets, then you should live that way. Well, live the life that you sing about in your song.
Well, I happen to worship the Prince of Peace, not war. And I think the wars that caused the deaths of dozens or thousands of people on either side should be conducted only if they meet very strict standards as a last resort. So I worship the Prince of Peace. I also believe that the basic tenet of my own particular faith, which happens to be Christianity, is to exalt and the needs of and the alleviation of problems of the poorest of our people instead of exalting the needs of the richest people in our country. I also believe that God ordained that we should be very careful stewards of the environment and other things of that kind. And so you can look at your own particular religious faith, as I've just done the last few seconds, and select certain parts that you think of paramount in importance.
Most people who, most former presidents seem to disappear or pop up every once in a while. Some play golf, others write their memoirs and then show up to explain why they have done what other people think they didn't really do. But you, here you are, you're painting, you said, you make furniture, you have a farm to take care of, you have the Carter Center, you teach Sunday school, you've written 18 books. Are you going to write another book, another novel now?
Yeah, I'm seriously considering writing a sequel to this one because so many intriguing things happened in the few decades immediately after the Revolutionary War. When we became a nation, we really didn't know what to do with it. And then all of the changes that take place, they are very intriguing to me, so I'm very seriously considering writing a sequel to this one.
Well, I assume that when you were researching this novel, you came upon all sorts of interesting things that you said, gee, I can't stick it in this book, but then maybe if I write another book, I'll do that.
Well, that's true. You have to remember, too, just Georgia, for instance, was only 30 miles wide. I mentioned that just alongside the Atlantic Ocean and just west of the Savannah River. All the rest of Georgia was totally controlled by the Indians all the way to the Mississippi River.
Until Jackson forced them out.
Until he forced them out in 1828. And then we got the land that we presently farm, where I was yesterday, in 1833. So we've had our land 170-something years. But the Indians were forced out. And then after the Revolutionary War, really, is when slavery came. And you also had the dispersing of those millions and millions of acres of land in a very illegal and improper way. So there are a lot of interrelationships that I can see would be intriguing, not only for fiction, but also for historical analysis.
Well, your mother lived a long time. There could be many novels in you.
Maybe
it's
one
in
more.
The genes. Meanwhile, I want to thank you so much for being here to talk about this one, The Hornet's Nest. By the way, Jimmy Carter will be reading and signing copies of The Hornet's Nest tonight at 7 o'clock at the Borders Bookstore at Columbus Circle. The Hornet's Nest is a novel of the Revolutionary War. It's now available in paperback from Simon & Schuster. What a great pleasure it's been talking with you today.
None of them enjoy being with you and with your many listeners.